Good evening, good day, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of the Indian Interest Podcast. I hope you're all doing very well. Before we begin, as always, let me see who all is there on the live chat and let me greet you all. I can see Yuvraj Banerjee, Dhanika, Tathagat, Manmat Tiwari, Manish, John, Sheena, Mayur, Jigar, Sukhadia, Aviral, Likhita, Bharadwaj, Krik, Big Hero, Nikhil Negi, Shrikant Bola, Tuti Futi, Shakti, Techno Mafia, Prince Chauhan, Shaili, Aditya Kumar Shaw, Trupti, Napster, Ashish Maurya, Prince Chauhan, Feminist Slayer, Auritro Di Caprio, Totan Chaudhary, Maikala Jatin, 020, Tushar Patil, Parth Naik, Matteo Perez, hello from Texas, hello, Tathagat, Techno Mafia, Ghost Rider, Divyang, Aryaman, Vinod, Shrikant, Ayushman, Mona Singh, Parth, Ujwal, Abhinav, Martian, Yash Srivastav, Yash Rao, Da Flanker, PJ Deb Barma, Sumedha, Jatin, Teja, Shivam, Tavish, Khush Kuhad, Manu Gowda, Appleseed, Dhruv Kumar, DK, Kunal, Vortex, Siddharth Patnaik, Nikhil Negi, Animish, Harshit, Harsh Jain, Yashas, Abhigya, and lots of other people. Thank you so much for being on the live stream. I really appreciate it. I will not be able to greet you all, but you have my greetings. All right, so what shall we talk about today? We will try and keep today's session reasonably brief. I mean, close to 1 hour. We usually exceed that by far, but let's try and keep it somewhat briefer today. So let's begin today's episode with what's happening in Ukraine. Let us put that on the screen and see what are the latest developments in Ukraine. So here's a news report by Mr. Zelensky talks about Bakhmut. So Zelensky warns of an open road through Bakhmut, through Ukraine's east, if Russia captures Bakhmut as he resists call to retreat. So as we know, for the past several months, there's been this protracted battle going on for the city of Bakhmut, which is in the Donbas region of Ukraine, which is now more or less de facto Russia. And for the longest time, the Western media, the Ukrainian media, etc., has been saying that Bakhmut is strategically irrelevant. Why is Russia spending so much effort, energy, ammunition, expending all this on this irrelevant city of Bakhmut? And now that the Russians are about to capture it, they are saying it's going to give the Russians an open road through Ukraine's east if this happens. So clearly, I mean, I have spoken about this before. The Western media has published lots and lots of articles saying they could not understand why Russia is fighting for an irrelevant, strategically irrelevant town. Well, now we understand that the Western media was trying to fool all of us. So this is an excellent example of why one should not trust the media, whether it's the Western media, whether it's the Indian media, which simply copies the West. We can't do that. You cannot afford to do that, otherwise you'll be misled. So now it looks like the Russians are on the verge of capturing Bakhmut. They have still left a road open for the Ukrainians to retreat, but Zelensky is unwilling to give the order for his soldiers to retreat. Obviously, Zelensky is not entirely in charge over here. He has his own masters to serve. So that's what is happening right now. In case you want to see where Bakhmut lies, let's go to the map, as always. And let's go to Ukraine. Where is Donbas? The Donbas region is over here. And let's find Bakhmut. Here is Bakhmut. This is the city of Bakhmut, and that's where all the fighting is happening. It's being called the Bakhmut meat grinder, which is a horrific term, but it accurately describes what's been happening there. So yeah, that is one of the things that is happening in Ukraine. The other big news out of Ukraine is this here. Russian missile barrage slams into Ukrainian cities, and apparently six people have died. This is from AP News, and this happened just a couple of days ago. It happened on March 10. Today is March 11, so like less than 48 hours, more or less. So it says 80 Russian missiles and a smaller number of exploding drones hit residential buildings and critical infrastructure. So across Ukraine, killing six people, leaving thousands, hundreds of thousands without heat or electricity. The Zaporizhia nuclear plant is being mentioned over here. So yes, that is something the Russians have done. A massive missile barrage slams into Ukrainian cities. And this is another report of the same thing. Russia conducts hypersonic rain on Ukraine, uses bombers, fighters, warships, and drones for strikes. So it's not warships that are going and striking these cities. It's just the fact that many of these missiles can be launched from warships in the Black Sea region. The Russians have done that many times in the past, launching cruise missiles from warships. Hypersonic rain, they are referring to the Kinjal missile, which is a hypersonic missile. It's something that the Ukrainians don't have any defense from. The Russians employed 81 missiles of various types, including the Kinjal hypersonic missiles. And this is an article from The Guardian, our best friend. And it kind of gives you a map of what happened. It's even struck the city of Lviv in the far west of Ukraine. In case you don't know, Lviv has a very notorious reputation during the Second World War. The citizens of Lviv conducted pogroms against the local Jews. Horrific affair. So yeah, when Mr. Putin talks about the denazification of Ukraine, he's referring to actual things that happened on the ground. So Lviv today celebrates those events in a way, you know. So anyway, so Lviv has been struck, Kiev, Kharkiv, and Odessa, and many other places have been hit. If you want a more detailed map, this is a more detailed map. This is by a Twitter account. I'm not sure who runs it, but yeah, there we go. So Lviv does figure in it, and lots of other places have been hit as well. Kiev has been hit. They used kamikaze drones, which is the Iranian Shahed drones. They used cruise missiles and even the Kinjal hypersonic missile. So in Kiev, the engine room and boiler room of a large generating station was hit, which will cause outages of electricity. Kharkiv has been hit. Dnepropetrovsk has been hit. The region, Pavlograd, etc. And yeah, it's a whole list. It's a laundry list of the places that have been hit by the Russians. So the question is, you know, we were anticipating a winter offensive. The winter offensive never happened. Now everyone's anticipating a Russian spring offensive. The question is, has the spring offensive started? Has it commenced? There is no major tank assault on any part of Ukraine. There are no major infantry advances, but you are seeing this enormous strike through missiles mainly, which is definitely aimed at softening up the nation of Ukraine. So clearly something's happening and something is afoot. Is this the beginning of the spring offensive? We still can't say. Mr. Putin refrained from going ahead in winter. So he defied all conventional predictions. And the reason for that is very simple. You should never let anyone know what you're thinking, what you're planning, and always keep your enemies confused. So... So will there be a spring offensive? We still don't know. But yeah, this massive strike certainly seems to be something that would happen in preparation for a major offensive. So yeah, thus far, this is what's happened. And we don't have more information apart from that. So this is the situation in Ukraine right now. What else is happening in Ukraine? Well, take a look at this article by Politico magazine, which is an American magazine. It's an opinion piece. One of the most remarkable outcomes of the war in Ukraine has been Kiev's advancement of rights for LGBTQ people, a sharp rejection of Russia's effort to weaponize homophobia in support of its invasion. So the support for LGBTQ, all those people, is obviously American culture. It's the new American culture. So Ukraine is adopting this American trend. So this is the article itself, how Russia's war against Ukraine is advancing LGBTQ rights, apparently, which is very strange because Ukraine has historically been a very traditional society. Mr. Putin spoke about, you know, denazifying Ukraine. So they do very strongly espouse Nazi ideology. They had this Azov Brigade division, whatever it was, which is definitely a neo-Nazi brigade. And Nazi ideology is extremely anti-LGBTQ, if you want to put it that way. So it's the Ukrainians have not given up their Nazi ideology. You see them doing those Nazi salutes all the time. All the time, the soldiers and all that. You see it appearing all across social media. So it's very strange to see this opinion piece. On the one hand, they have not given up their Nazi ideology. Even when Ukrainian soldiers go to Germany for military training on tanks and all that, they're still doing those Nazi salutes in Germany. So how does one reconcile the fact that they are still very much espousing the Nazi ideology with this article which says that Ukraine is now advancing LGBTQ rights? So this looks like a complete, you know, non-factual opinion piece, but let's see what it says. So yeah, the Ukrainian leadership is definitely trying its best to appear more pro-America, pro-Washington DC, pro-West. We are being shown some examples of this. But yeah, there you go. Ukrainians and their leaders did not immediately recognize LGBTQ people's rights. Over the past decade, many pride parades have been met with hostility or violence. So yeah, that's typically, traditionally, how Ukrainian society has been. But yeah, apparently, according to this piece, opinion piece, Ukraine is now beginning to become more progressive, more democratic, more liberal, and more pro-LGBTQ, which means more pro-America. That is the situation right now. Well, apart from that, I have not seen anything else of note happening in Ukraine. The situation is still kind of like a frozen conflict. Not really frozen conflict, but a stagnant conflict. The L line of actual control or line of control is more or less still the same. There is this focus on Bakhmut. And Bakhmut seems to be on the verge of falling. A month or so ago, the neighboring town of Solidar with the salt mines fell to the Wagner division, to the Wagner group, which is the Russian irregular fighters. And now Bakhmut may be on the verge of, is definitely on the verge of falling to the Russians. So that could give rise to a spring offensive, possibly. We know that the first Rasputitsa season of the year is now underway, the mud season. The snows are now melting, and you can see mud across Ukraine's countryside. So that is the situation in Ukraine as of now. What shall we talk about? Let's talk about Georgia. Now, we don't usually refer to Georgia much. I'm not sure if most people even know where Georgia is. So let's take a look at this town, this small country of Georgia, and why is it suddenly relevant in the world today? So where is it? Here it is. So what's happening in Georgia? This is from March 8, this tweet. Anti-government protests in Tbilisi, Georgia. The country is not joining the anti-Russian coalition and introduces laws to regulate foreign agents. And then the result is protests. We know the drill. So this country refuses to become anti-Russia. It refuses to join the anti-Russia coalition, which is the West. And it introduces laws to regulate foreign agents in the country. And as a result of that, there are protests. Well, what does this sound like? Have we seen this before somewhere? Georgia, that country looks like on the verge of another color revolution. So this is called a color revolution. It's an artificially induced revolution, which is essentially mediated from outside. It's mediated from the West. It's mediated typically from Washington, D.C. That's how it goes. The previous one was conducted by Mikhail Saakashvili and paid off by NED and Soros. We were talking about this guy in our film Ukraine on Fire. So this gentleman, Igor Lopatonok, is the director of the movie Ukraine on Fire, which is an extremely interesting movie, which shows a lot of what really happened in the build-up to the Ukraine war. So there's a color revolution underway in Ukraine. Mass protests are taking place in Georgia after the country's parliament passed a bill designating NGOs and media that receive more than 20% of their funding from abroad as foreign agents. Who are the people protesting? The foreign agents. Isn't that nice? So how does the West interfere in the internal affairs of other nations? Well, one of the nicest ways of doing it is through NGOs. NGOs are a big, you know, it's a very lucrative thing to do if you want to receive foreign money. Just start an NGO and be open to, and obviously you need to have a network of contacts and all those things. And if you have that, then it will be possible for you to receive foreign funding to promote democracy and human rights and Western liberal values, etc., in your country. So much of this foreign interference happens through NGOs. NGOs are essentially foreign agents operating in these countries. This may remind you of something more closer to home as well. India has more NGOs than schools. India has more NGOs than hospitals. You have no idea how many NGOs are in India. There are more NGOs than schools and hospitals in India. It's an entire industry. And some of these NGOs, I would not say many of them, but some of these NGOs are funded from abroad. I'm not talking about only the West. There are other places also from where the funds come in. And when funding comes from abroad, when you are funded by somebody, you're going to promote their interest. You're going to do what they tell you to do, obviously. Otherwise, the funding ends. And that's not good for you. So obviously, the deal is that if you get X amount of funding, you can take a cut out of it. And then the rest of it has to be used for whatever your masters want you to do. That's how it works. India has gazillions of NGOs. So this is what's happening in Georgia. The country's parliament passed a bill designating NGOs that receive more than 20% of their funding from abroad as foreign agents. And then we have protests all of a sudden, spontaneously apparently. Yeah. And the people protesting are the foreign agents, obviously. Let's see. Okay, so if you want to see where Georgia is, it's in the Caucasus region, the Black Sea region for sure. So where are we? Here we are. So it's south of Russia in the Black Sea coastal region. And as you can see, there are some dashed lines over here. You have Abkhazia and South Ossetia, which are more or less controlled by Russia. But Georgia has refused to participate in the anti-Russia coalition and then pass this law. As a result of that, we are seeing this attempted color revolution mediated by the West in Georgia. So the person who's being targeted mainly is the Prime Minister of Georgia, Irakli Garibashvili. He is the person being targeted. They want to remove him and get somebody, more pliable in power in his position as a puppet. The other prominent politician involved in this matter is this lady, Salome Zurabichvili. She's the president. This gentleman is the prime minister. Now, this lady was in New York when this happened. And she immediately expressed her support for the protesters, which means support for the color revolution. Now, this lady was born in Paris and she had French citizenship. And she was even a French diplomat. And then she acquired Georgian citizenship because her roots apparently are in Georgia, her heritage, ancestry. That's the game that's being played. This is the news report. Georgian president, this lady, Salome, whatever her name is, supports protests against foreign agents bill. So I am with you because you represent free Georgia now, she said, from the US. How nice. And this is an interesting tweet. When you see a protest, look at the language they use. Usually, genuine protests are in the language of that particular country or area. Very interesting tweet. If you see English on an anti-X country sign, then you can assume it's definitely backed by the West and packaged to a Western audience or for a Western audience. Isn't that interesting? So these protests have lots of English placards and all that. And yeah, it's clear it's being, you know, orchestrated from the West. Now, this bill, this law that the Parliament of Georgia tried to pass, the Americans are saying it's something that's pro-Russia. But the truth is that it's actually inspired by American law itself. Take a look at this. Cornell Law School, this particular code, 22 US code, whatever, 611. So this is essentially the same thing. The Americans have exactly the same kind of law that designates, that defines what kind of person or organization is a foreign agent, agent of a foreign principal. And you can go through it. The Americans have the exact same kind of law. So the Georgians were trying to enact a law that is inspired by the American law, which we are seeing on the screen now. Here's and so that's the thing. So Georgia then was forced, because of these protests, by the magnitude of the protests and the way they are being conducted and the fact that they are ongoing, they have been forced to drop the bill on foreign agents after two nights of violent protests. So they have been forced to backtrack and withdraw this bill. And yet the protests are going on. Even after they have withdrawn the bill, the protests are still ongoing. So yeah, there you are. So it's not working. The West is intent on a color revolution in Georgia. And what's interesting is that, you know, last week I think I spoke about Transnistria, the territory on the left bank, I think, of the Dnieper, or was it the right? The territory in the east of Moldova that essentially is controlled by Russia, that supports Russia. I had spoken about that. Now, what do we see happen? I spoke about it last week, and here you have this. Transnistria accuses Ukraine of trying to kill its president. This is, what date is it? March 9. So it's essentially just 2 days ago. So let's see more. Transnistria accuses Ukraine of organizing assassination attempt of its president. Moldovan breakaway region known for close Moscow ties and for hosting Russian troops and for having one of the largest ammunition depots in the entirety of Europe. So there is an attempt. There was an attempt to assassinate the president. Transnistrian Special Service foils assassination attempt on Republic's top officials. Grenade launchers were fired at an ammunition depot near the village of Kobasna, which has that enormous ammunition depot, which serves as a storage facility for roughly 20,000 tons of ammunition removed from European countries after Soviet troops withdrew. So something is afoot. Something is afoot over here in Transnistria. Something is afoot in Georgia as well. Interesting days are here. So, like I said, Moldova is over here, and Transnistria is this region in the east of Moldova. All right, it's over here. And the capital of Transnistria is Tiraspol. So, the Americans, well, it's the Americans. Who else is it? They are stirring up trouble in Georgia. And the Transnistrians are accusing Ukraine of attempting to assassinate the president and high-ranking officials. So we have two new fronts that the West is opening against Russia. Russia is already embroiled in the Ukraine conflict. They are trying to fight their way in and maybe possibly launch a spring offensive if they deem it necessary. And now we have the possibility that Georgia could become a pro-Western nation. There could be a coup in Georgia, a regime change operation. And then Georgia could become another trouble spot for the Russians. And their stronghold of Transnistria seems to be under attack as well. So multiple fronts are being opened up by the West against Russia. Now, what options does Russia have? I think it will be very easy for Russia to get into Georgia, you know, a military incursion, military invasion, if they so deem, if they so desire, if they think it's worthwhile. Georgia is not a powerful nation. It will be a cakewalk for the Russians. But if they do that, there could be trouble in Transnistria. Maybe the Americans would have the ammunition depot blown up which would be the equivalent of a Hiroshima nuclear bomb kind of situation, and then they can blame Russia for it, and you know, place more pressure on Russia, and more consequences will come in. So yeah, Russia is facing tough choices right now. The Americans have, in a sense, in Europe and in the Caucasus region, etc., kind of encircled Russia. They're applying pressure on multiple fronts. And yeah, Mr. Putin has certain choices to make. How is he going to deal with the Georgia situation? What's he going to do about Transnistria? The Russian forces are still way, way far away from Transnistria. They are nowhere close to Kherson or Odessa. Kherson, maybe they may be in range, but Odessa is still quite far away, and Transnistria is much further away. So if something happens in Transnistria, the Russian army, the armed forces, are not really in a position to come to the rescue of the people of Transnistria and the government of Transnistria. That's the situation right now. So tough choices for Mr. Putin. Obviously, the West will not make it easy for Russia. They're going to do their best to stir the pot and stir up trouble. So, yeah, that is the situation in Georgia. A coup is being attempted right now as we speak. The protests are still ongoing despite the government withdrawing those bills, that bill. And there is trouble in Transnistria as well. Yeah, so that is the fraught situation in this region, which all stems out of the Ukraine conflict. Now let's come closer to home and let's talk about India-Australia relations. So the Prime Minister of Australia, Mr. Albanese, was in India recently, in the last couple of days. So here we have this tweet from our Prime Minister, Mr. Modi. Delighted to meet my friend, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese in Delhi. Our talks focused on diverse subjects, including maritime cooperation, defense, renewable energy, trade, and education. Key agreements were also signed today, which will boost people-to-people contacts, ties between India and Australia. So some nice photographs are being put out. As you can see, this is what happened. India and Australia are also, they also have this free trade agreement, and there could be a further free trade agreement coming up in 2024. So a lot of activity happening, and Australia is important, obviously, for India for a number of reasons. It's in our neighborhood. Australia is not that far away. It's in the Indian Ocean region, and obviously it's a proxy of the US. It's part of the Five Eyes coalition, which is led by the US. It's also part of the Quad. It is a nation that fears China and feels threatened by China. So India and Australia have a lot in common. Obviously, India is not part of the Five Eyes, and India is not a proxy of the US, but you know, from all those angles, it makes sense to cooperate with Australia. And nowadays, lots of Indian students go to Australia for education. Lots of Indian origin people live in Australia. So all these things are there. And that's why it is important for India and Australia to have excellent relations. So what else happened? Mr. Albanese says that for Australia, India is a top security partner. Interesting image. He is on the Indian aircraft carrier, INS Vikramaditya, Vikrant, I believe, yes. So the Indian Ocean is central to both countries' security and prosperity. We are working together to ensure the Indo-Pacific is open, inclusive, and prosperous. Excellent sentiments. While on board the Vikrant in Mumbai today, I met with incredible service personnel from the Indian Navy who have undertaken exercises with Australia. I was pleased to formally announce Australia will host Exercise Malabar for the first time later this year, bringing together the Australian Navy, the Indian Navy, the US Navy, and the Japanese Navy. Excellent. So, yeah, that is what is happening here. A beautiful ceremonial welcome at Rashtrapati Bhavan in New Delhi with Prime Minister Narendra Modi. He has been given an excellent welcome, very warm welcome. More of that over here. And other interactions, IIT, New Delhi, students and faculty, great to see that. He met with the President of India, Her Excellency Draupadi Murmu. He also met with Dr. S. Jaishankar, the foreign minister of India. Excellent. More of that, more photo opportunities and all those things. The obligatory homage to Mr. Gandhi that every foreign leader does in India. No surprise there. And so speaking to the media in New Delhi before heading to the US, where I will be meeting with Joe Biden and Rishi Sunak to progress the AUKUS agreement. So the AUKUS agreement is the sale of American nuclear submarines to Australia, and they backed out of the French agreement, their agreement with France, which has caused the French a great amount of heartburn. But yeah, so he's on his way to the US, where he will meet with Joe Biden and Rishi Sunak, which, you know, two other Five Eyes nations. Now, what else happened? This is interesting. So I have seen reports of attacks on temples in Australia. I have conveyed this to Prime Minister Albanese, and he has assured me that the safety and well-being of the Indian community in Australia is a priority for them. That's what Prime Minister Modi said. This is an interesting development. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi calls on Anthony Albanese to combat attacks on temples in Australia. That's interesting. Indian PM criticizes Albanese over recent Melbourne Hindu temple attacks. So this is something that's very interesting. It's something that usually Indian leaders don't do. Mr. Modi has typically never done this. In this joint meeting, this joint press conference, he spoke about this, that he raised the issue of the attacks on Hindu temples, Indian temples in Australia. It you could construe that as a public criticism of the Australian government, because there doesn't seem to have been much done by the Australian government to prevent this, and not much action seems to have been taken. So this was a very rare public criticism, so to say, of the Australian government and of a foreign leader, you know, a leader of a nation who has come to India. But Mr. Modi deemed it necessary to do it in this manner. So interesting messaging and signaling that's being sent out. On the one hand, we have given the Prime Minister of Australia an excellent, very warm, very enthusiastic welcome. He has been made to feel very welcome in India. India and Australia are cooperating on so many different fronts. That is definitely there. But also, the Prime Minister himself, in public, standing right next to the Australian Prime Minister, issued what you could definitely construe as a criticism of what his government is doing, and or of how little his government is doing or has thus far done to ensure the safety of these temples that have been that are under attack in Australia. Interesting signaling. It shows that India has more of a spine now. This is something that no previous prime minister could even dream of doing in India. So, or anywhere else. Yep. So it shows that Indian foreign policy is much more confident now, much more robust, and has much more of a spine than before. India will stand up for its national interest and the interest of its diaspora, who may not be Indian citizens necessarily, but who may be persons of Indian origin. They may have PIO cards, or they may just be Indian origin people who live abroad. So we're gonna look out for them as well, even though they may not be our citizens. That's what the Indian foreign policy is like now, which is good to see. Right, let's talk about something else. Let's talk about the United States. Take a look at this piece of news. So the New York Times says, breaking news, the Pentagon is blocking the US from sharing evidence on Russian atrocities in Ukraine with the International Criminal Court, officials said. Military leaders fear setting a precedent that might pave the way for it to prosecute Americans. There's a lot to unpack in this, and there's this there's the article over here. Obviously, I'm not subscribed to the New York Times, so I don't need to, I don't want to, but yeah. So let's unpack what this is saying. The Pentagon is blocking the US. What do they mean by the US? It actually means the US government, which means the Joe Biden administration, which is based out of the White House. The Pentagon is the other pentagonal building which houses the defense establishment of the US, which is informally, colloquially called the deep state. So what this tells you is that the Pentagon is blocking the White House from sharing evidence on whatever it is mentioned over here. The Pentagon is blocking the US president from doing something that he wants to do. The Pentagon is blocking the US president's administration from doing something it wants to do. What does this tell us, my friends? This tells us that the Pentagon is more powerful than the White House. It can veto the White House. It can block the White House from doing certain things if it so desires. The military establishment in the US is more powerful than the democratically elected government of the US. The military establishment is not elected by anyone. It's unelected. It's permanent. And that's what they call the deep state. Let's come closer to home. Pakistan occupied Punjab. There is this city called Rawalpindi in Pakistan occupied Punjab. The Pakistani military establishment is based out of Rawalpindi. The Pakistani government is based out of this city called Islamabad. We all know that Rawalpindi is way more powerful than Islamabad. We are seeing a very similar situation here. The Pentagon is actually visibly now more powerful than the White House, than the democratically elected government of the United States. There is your American democracy. US democracy anyway is kind of a farce. It's a two-state, two-party system, which is just one step above the Chinese Communist Party's one-party system and the North Korean one-party system. The US is just one step above that. It's a two-party system. Everything is force-fitted into two parties. And both the parties essentially have the same defense and foreign policy, which is support of endless war. And now Joe Biden and his administration wanted to go to the International Criminal Court in The Hague, in the Netherlands, and share evidence of apparent Russian atrocities in Ukraine. And the Pentagon said, no, we will not allow you to do this. Won't happen. You just can't do it. Because if you do it, then other nations like Russia, China, etc., could use the same precedent to prosecute Americans for American war crimes. Because we all know what the Americans have been doing for decades around the world. Color revolutions, regime changes, coups, installing puppets, installing dictators, creating civil wars, bombing the hell out of cities and nations, carpet bombing Baghdad, carpet bombing Tripoli. We know what they did in Iraq, the highway of death during the first invasion, the first oil war, Gulf War. The history of this goes back more than a century. The American war on the Philippines, the atomic tests on the civilians of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the firebombing of Dresden, these are all war crimes. These are just a small sample of what the Americans have done. So if the White House goes to The Hague and gives evidence of Russian atrocities in Ukraine, then a precedent will be set which can be used against the United States itself. And there's much more that you can do to the United States in this manner. So the Pentagon has blocked Joe Biden and his administration from taking this step. So this clearly tells us that the relationship between the Pentagon and the White House is essentially the same as the relationship between Rawalpindi and Islamabad. Pakistan is not a democracy. We all know that. Now there's the same situation in the US. All right? This is what I tweeted. What does this tell you? The Pentagon is more powerful than the White House. This is somebody else on Twitter talking about this. Reminder that the US has a law known informally as the Hague Invasion Act, which quite literally authorizes the president of the US to invade the Hague if the International Criminal Court ever goes after any US or allied personnel, which means that whatever international law exists in the world doesn't apply to the US. The Americans can even invade the Hague, where the International Criminal Court resides, if they decide to prosecute Americans. And here is the law. American Service Members Protection Act, known informally as the Hague Invasion Act. So no law applies to the US. They can do anything they want. They can invade any nation they want anytime they deem it necessary. Incredible. So that's why we have to understand the US is actually an empire. It's not a nation state, it's an empire. And who runs the US? It's definitely not the US president. The Pentagon is way more powerful than the White House. We know that Joe Biden is not a fully functional human being. We don't know where his mind is. He when he speaks, by the end of the sentence, he's not quite sure what the beginning of the sentence was. That's the kind of mental state he is in. He's not a fully functional, cognitively normal human being, but he's the president of the US. So clearly he's not the guy in charge, and clearly it's not his administration that's in charge. There's something else, that there's another entity somewhere else that actually operates and runs and governs the United States. That's what they call the deep state. So I think it's all coming out in the open now. Until very recently, talking about the deep state was being a conspiracy theorist. It was all conspiracy theories. Now, government officials of various nations talk about it openly. The deep state. I can show you tweets by Indian government officials also that reference the deep state. So everyone knows now that it exists. And it's way more powerful than the democratically, apparently, elected government of the United States. So this is something that's now coming out in the open, and the Americans they essentially no longer care if the world sees through what's happening. Interesting situation. And now, obviously, let's talk about what the thumbnail of this live stream promises, which is China. China is under pressure. Now, let's talk about what's happening in China. Where is this? Okay, let's share this on the screen. So President Xi Jinping, Mr. Xi, has been re-elected or selected, whatever you want to call it, for a third term, a historic third term as China's president. So he is essentially the Chinese emperor. And the dynasty he belongs to is the Chinese Communist Party. It's a continuing dynastic cycle. So there you have it. Mr. Xi begins historic third term as China's president. He is all powerful in China. He has essentially unlimited powers. The Chinese Communist Party acknowledges him as the supreme leader. He essentially has no political opposition left in the Chinese Communist Party. He has ensured all of it is dealt with. What else do we have? Yes, this. So the vote happened, and the votes for Mr. Xi Jinping were 2,952, and the votes against him were zero. That was closed. That was close. So that's the kind of democracy you have in China. You have elections, but nobody votes against the emperor. Nobody dares vote against the emperor. So it's all a formality. What else? So yes, Xi Jinping, rise of the Red Emperor. So the world acknowledges the fact that he essentially is the emperor, not the president of China. He is much more than that. China is an aspiring empire, and Mr. Xi Jinping is the emperor of China. Now, this is an interesting piece of news that's come out. Interesting development. Iran and Saudi Arabia agree to resume ties with China's help. So for the past several years, Iran and Saudi Arabia did not have any diplomatic ties at all. They'd broken off diplomatic ties. There was a very hostile situation that existed between the two nations. And so now, with China's help, with China's involvement, the two nations have agreed to resume ties. they have reached some kind of compromise, and this agreement was signed in Beijing. So what you can see is that China still has a lot of influence. China actually seems to have, its influence seems to be growing in the Persian Gulf region, the Middle East region, and US influence seems to be waning. It's on the downturn. So the US is losing influence in this region. The Chinese, China, is gaining influence in this region. The Saudis want to be part of BRICS. The Iranians also want to be part of BRICS. If Saudi Arabia and Iran become part of BRICS, this agreement could be a precursor to that. So that could be a big blow for the US. But let's understand something very clearly. There is an enormous amount of difference between influence and power. You may lose influence, but your power still remains. Power is a whole different beast. Influence is not power. Power is not influence. Power is something much harder than influence. Influence is like soft power, and power is the actual hard power. It's military and economic power. So the American power has not waned. Influence has waned. China's power hasn't increased in this region. China has very little power there, but it has influence. The leaders of the Middle East are willing to listen to China, talk to China, and allow China to get involved in these diplomatic matters, because they don't see China as much of a threat as they see the United States. And just look at the history of the US. The Middle East has been on the boil for the past 70, 80 years. Constant crisis. Well, who creates this crisis constantly? Who keeps fomenting it? It's the West. Yeah, it's all because of outside interference. So there we have it. The Chinese have succeeded in negotiating a diplomatic breakthrough in the Middle East between these two staunch rivals, Iran and Saudi Arabia. So there you have it. The Chinese are actually able to increase their influence in this region. And this is a statement by a joint statement by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the Islamic Republic of Iran, and the People's Republic of China. And this is from the Foreign Ministry of Saudi Arabia. And they talk about Xi Jinping in the first sentence itself. In response to the noble initiative of His Excellency President Xi Jinping, President of the People's Republic of China, of China's support for developing good neighborly nations between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the Islamic Republic of Iran, and so on and so forth. So they are thanking China and Mr. Xi Jinping, and praising China and Xi Jinping. Interesting. So that's actually a positive development for China. Now let's take a look at Xi Jinping's foreign policy. In Xi's new era, China's foreign policy centers on struggle. Chinese officials hate the term wolf warrior diplomacy, but it's clear that that phenomenon, by whatever name, is here to stay. So China's diplomacy is going to continue to be hardline. China feels a lot of pressure. China feels like it's being squeezed from multiple sides, from multiple angles, and it's going to continue with its robust and aggressive diplomatic policy, the so-called wolf warrior diplomacy, which the term, they don't like it, but they're going to continue with that. China says the US should change attitude or risk conflict. So we are seeing more and more harsh statements from the Chinese government. The tone is becoming more strident. So this is what the Chinese foreign minister said on Tuesday. The United States should change its distorted attitude towards China, or conflict and confrontation will follow. This is what the Chinese foreign minister said on Tuesday while defending its stance on the war in Ukraine and its close ties with Russia. China's new foreign minister, Qin Gang, warned that conflict and confrontation with the US is inevitable if Washington does not change course. So it looks like China is resigned to an impending conflict of some kind with the US, or definitely at least a further deterioration in ties between China and the US. China's new foreign minister warns of conflict with the US, defends Russia ties. That's the article. What else? Why China has sharpened its anti-American rhetoric. Washington has become a convenient scapegoat for Beijing. This is obviously the foreign policy website, which is run by the Americans. So it's gonna be very opinionated in this manner. So that's that. China is selling their U.S. treasuries. The People's Bank of China has added 102 tons of gold in the past 4 months. Total gold reserves now amount to 2,050 tons. China is clearly trying to limit their counterparty risk in a conflict, paper to hard assets. So the Chinese are taking these actions, which seem to be in preparation for some kind of conflict with the U.S. Washington is headed for conflict and confrontation. Yeah, we spoke about that. Now, take a look at this. This is from March 2 this year, which is like 9 days ago. Taiwan military to get $619 million U.S. arms boost as China keeps up pressure. So the Americans want China to not help Russia in the Ukraine war. They want China to not send any military equipment to Russia. That's what the Americans want. At the same time, they are supplying more than $500 million of weapons to Taiwan, to the Taiwanese military, to keep China under pressure. Interesting? Yes. This is an article from when? This is an article from February 23 this year, which is like, you know, less than a month ago. U.S. to expand troop presence in Taiwan for training against China threat. So the U.S. is bolstering its presence in Taiwan. The U.S. is bolstering the Taiwanese military's military muscle. At the same time, it's asking China to not help Russia and to not supply weapon systems, arms, ammunition to Russia. Double standards? Definitely. But yeah, that is what's happening. Now, what else? China's Xi Jinping himself takes rare direct aim at the U.S. in speech. He blames Washington-led containment, encirclement, and suppression for challenges at home. So China is definitely being encircled by the U.S. On the one hand, we have Japan, which is under U.S. occupation, very heavily militarized by the U.S. military. Then you have South Korea, which is under U.S. military occupation, again, very heavily militarized. Taiwan, which is a U.S. proxy, sort of, so you could consider it that way, also very heavily militarized by the Americans. It's encirclement, isn't it? It's definitely interesting. I don't blame the Chinese for feeling this way. This is indeed a fact. Then obviously you have the Quad grouping of nations, the US, Australia, Japan, and India. Now let's not blame India for being part of this. The only reason India is part of this is because the Chinese have been, well, provoking India for the longest time. China is the aggressor in the India-China relationship. China has always been the aggressor in the India-China relationship. They have gone to war with India at least twice, 62 and 67. 62 they won, 67 they lost. There was a 1987 incident as well. And they keep on provoking India at the border, keep on trying to intrude into Indian territory and nibble at bits of Indian territory. They claim large amounts of Indian territory after taking Tibet. So clearly, China is the aggressor over here. And that's the reason why India has become part of the Quad, because that makes sense. So, yeah, that's the Quad. What else? This is an unprecedented statement by Xi. Western countries led by the US have implemented all-round containment, encirclement, and suppression against us, bringing unprecedentedly severe challenges to our country's development. Well, the Chinese, see, they complain about the US empire and the US encirclement of their country, but they themselves have this extremely, you know, this expansionist mindset. They have border disputes, territorial disputes with each and every one of their neighbors. Every neighboring country that they have territorial disputes. And these are all, you know, initiated by the Chinese, and the Chinese claim territories of every nation. They have encroached upon Bhutanese territory. They have encroached upon Nepalese territory. They want Afghan territory, Tajik territory, Kyrgyz territory. They are even now laying claim on Russian territory. They are claiming the entirety of the South China Sea. So they themselves are behaving like an expansionist imperial power. and their rise is definitely not peaceful. So it's nice to see them complain about this, but I would say they only have themselves to blame. What else? China's position on the political settlement of the Ukraine crisis. This is about less than a month ago. So respecting the sovereignty of all countries, abandoning the Cold War mentality, ceasing hostilities, resuming peace talks, resolving the humanitarian crisis, protecting civilians and prisoners of war, keeping nuclear power plants safe, reducing strategic risks, facilitating grain exports, stopping unilateral sanctions, keeping industrial and supply chains stable, promoting post-conflict resolution. This is a statement given out by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of China. This looks like the statement that they would give out if there is a war between India, between China and the US. Even though they're talking about Ukraine, it's the exact kind of statement they would give out if there is a war between China and the US. This is what they would want, and this is what they are talking about. China's Ukraine peace plan is actually about Taiwan. So this is the foreign policy website. So, yeah. Beijing's phony proposal lays bare its conditions for winning an East Asian war. So that is the situation right now. The Chinese are feeling the heat. The Americans are ramping up the pressure on China. They're supplying Taiwan with more arms and ammunition. They're sending more U.S. military personnel to Taiwan. We know already that the Quad activities are going on. So there's a significant amount of pressure on China. The Americans have imposed these semiconductor sanctions on China to kill off the Chinese semiconductor industry. And then China has done all these blunders of its own volition. The horrific lockdowns that went on for months and months, maybe years, as part of the coronavirus pandemic, which destroyed the morale of the Chinese population, which has caused immense hardship to the people of China. Industrial production dropped. The GDP is crashed. It's contracting. Yes, it is not over. The Chinese manufacturing machine still works, but the GDP figures tell the entire story. The GDP is crawling now. It's contracting possibly. You cannot really trust the GDP figures that come out of China. These are usually manufactured and doctored. So the Chinese economy is in this crisis, almost like a recession. The housing bubble seems to be on the verge of popping. There are all these problems. The birth rate has dropped horrifically. The total fertility rate is below 1.2 now in China, which is a catastrophe by any standards. And yet, the dropping birth rate and the fact that the Chinese population is going to drop very drastically over the next 60, 70, 80 years, and the fact that the population is going to age a lot, the median age is going to be 60 plus eventually, that doesn't affect China today. As of today, China still is a very major economy, a very powerful nation. Its economy is like almost five times that of India. Its military might is much larger than that of India, but it's dispersed and focused elsewhere. So China understands that it's in trouble. It understands what the Americans are doing. And the Chinese tried to negotiate some kind of compromise with the US. In Bali, when the last G20 summit was held, the Chinese tried to negotiate some kind of compromise or some kind of arrangement, some kind of settlement with the US, some kind of understanding that would allow the Chinese and the US to keep cooperating in certain matters. That didn't work. There were at least two visits of American delegates, of American diplomats and officials to China. And lots of negotiations were held. So the Chinese were very keen on reaching some kind of compromise with the Americans, which would stave off this hostile conflict situation that we are seeing now. All of this was derailed by one incident. You know what that incident was? It was the balloon incident, the spy balloon incident. The Chinese sent spy balloons, one spy balloon over the US, and the Americans allowed it to wander over the US and eventually shot it down over the Atlantic Ocean. So this incident derailed the Chinese hope for some kind of compromise or agreement or arrangement with the US. So now it's almost open hostility. the Chinese obviously want Taiwan. They are in no position to take it. So now they are cooperating with Russia. So we are witnessing a very rapid reordering of the global order. We are now seeing the emergence of a multipolar world order. We have the US, the sole superpower. We have China, the once aspiring superpower, but it's no longer aspiring. I mean, it's no longer in a position to become a superpower. The Chinese are cooperating with Russia. So China and Russia can be seen as one block or one pole. And obviously, Russia cannot trust China because China covets Russian territory as well. And then you have nations like India and France, which are great powers, major powers, but not superpowers. Maybe aspiring superpowers in the long run, maybe 20 years from now, India can think seriously of becoming a superpower. So you have nations like India and France, and even nations like let's say Turkey, which is also an aspiring great power. So we have multipolarity now. And all the global south, so-called global south nations, like the African nations, etc., if you watch media reports now, they are all pushing back against the colonial powers, like France. Recently, the president of Congo publicly rebuked the president of France, Monsieur Macron, about his foreign minister's criticism or interference in Congo's internal matters. And then you had another incident in Namibia where the president of Namibia rebuked the German foreign minister in public, live on TV, when he started talking about the Chinese presence in Namibia. The president of Namibia said, "It's none of your concern. Stay out of our business." So now African nations are pushing back against the colonial powers, the European powers. So we are witnessing a very significant change in the global geopolitical climate. All the so-called global South nations are now, you could say, flocking towards India. India recently held a meeting of so-called global South nations in New Delhi. So India is creating a new movement of some kind. It's definitely not a non-aligned movement because India is not non-aligned. India is multi-aligned. But India is now a major power. Not a superpower, but definitely a major power, a great power. And India is the only power that does not have imperialistic and expansionist ambitions. India does not play the debt trap diplomacy, which means that the African nations don't see India as a threat the way they are wary of China. So there is a natural convergence of interests. So India is becoming the leader of the global South. That's something that's happening. Russia and China are not part of that movement. So there is a Russia-China bloc. Russia obviously does not trust China 100%, which it is wise not to. Russia actually would like to cooperate more with India. But yeah, there are these strategic imperatives that it has, which necessitate its cooperation with China. So we are seeing this extremely complex multipolar world order emerging. There are at least three or four major poles: the US, China, Russia, India, France as well. Even Turkey you could throw in. Even Iran you could throw in. So, and the global South nations. Some people think talk about Brazil as a major power. I disagree with that. Brazil is not a major power, despite its size, geographical size, and so on. So, multipolarity is emerging. We are witnessing the emergence of a multipolar world order. How long will the situation continue? Multipolarity? Maybe a decade or so. And then the contours of the geopolitical landscape will become more sharply defined, and maybe you will have two powers or three powers that will vie for the big cake, which is global dominance. So by the end of this decade, perhaps India, China, Russia, and the US could be the major powers left. Maybe France may be part of it, and all other nations would have gravitated towards one of these major powers. India is going to keep rising. India's economy is going to keep growing. Nothing is going to stop that. China's economy is in the doldrums. It's still definitely a very large economy, but things don't look good for China. Its superpower ambitions are definitely derailed. Its Belt and Road Initiative is definitely derailed. Its maritime Silk Route is definitely not happening the way it wanted it to happen. So these were the means, these are the vehicles that were supposed to propel China to superpower status. That is not happening. And the US is now trying to squeeze China. The US is trying to, well, the European nations, the EU nations, are now in the process of decoupling with China. They are looking for alternatives to China's manufacturing prowess. So there is this definite decoupling that's happening between the EU and China. So this places China under a lot of pressure. If it keeps manufacturing, where does it export all those goods to? Who's going to buy it? The EU doesn't want to buy it anymore. The Americans are trying to decouple from China, other nations as well. So despite all of the good things that seem to be happening vis-a-vis China, Mr. Xi Jinping is the undisputed emperor of China. Nobody can dispute that. They are able to increase their influence to some extent in the Middle East. That's a good thing that's happening. But despite all of this good news, the long-term prospects for China don't look good. The US is way more powerful than China. Its influence may be decreasing, but its power still remains intact. The US is all-powerful across the globe. That's why it's called a superpower. The Chinese can't even take back Taiwan from their own backyard. That's how powerful the US is. The US is applying the squeeze on China. The EU is cooperating and complying. Other nations will comply. India obviously is going to side with the US in this matter. The Chinese are now saying that they want a normal border situation with India. They are talking peace with India. The Chinese foreign minister was in India very recently, like last week, and he spoke about the fact that India and China need to normalize the situation and we need to cooperate, collaborate, all those things. So the Chinese are now feeling the heat, feeling the pressure, and because they are feeling the heat and pressure, they are trying to act nice with India. What we have to understand is that we can never trust China. The Chinese will, you know, when they're under pressure, they'll sing a certain tune. And when the pressure is released, they will sing a whole different tune. The nature of the Chinese Communist Party is not going to change. It's going to remain an aspiring imperial power, a hegemonic power, an expansionist power. Right now, they're under pressure, so they're talking nice. But we simply cannot afford to trust China. So is this the beginning of China's decline? It's too early to say that, but the long-term prospects are not good. The economy is not doing well. It's not projected to keep doing well at all. The population, the demographic disaster is there. It's on its way. And the global geopolitical climate is now very much anti-China. No one trusts China. Nobody trusts China anymore, especially after the coronavirus pandemic. So things are looking bad for China. And that actually makes China a more dangerous nation. It's still an enormously powerful nation, a huge economy. It has all that muscle, economic muscle and military muscle. And if you place such a nation under enormous pressure, it becomes more dangerous. So India has to be very careful. From our perspective, we cannot trust China's nice words that we want peace and normalcy at the border, all those things. We have to remain extremely wary. And this is actually a more dangerous phase that we are going through now, because this nation is not getting what it wants. And that can, you know, if the Chinese economy doesn't do well, if things start going bad, it's going to place huge amounts of pressure on Mr. Xi Jinping. And to release that pressure, he may indulge in some military misadventure somewhere. So there's this extremely complex scenario going on. Right now, it looks like the Chinese would want Mr. Modi to continue on as Prime Minister after the 24 elections, because they would like to see a strong government in India. If a strong government is there in India, it will not be pro-US, it will be independent foreign policy. If a weak government comes to power, it's going to be very strongly pro-US, because the Americans have way deeper pockets than the Chinese. So temporarily, the Chinese may be favorable to good relations with India temporarily, but it's not a long-term prospect. So that is the China story. China is not doing well. China is not going to continue doing well. It has influence. It's increasing its influence. But overall, the prospects are not good for China. And that's dangerous for India. So we have to keep a very close eye on the Chinese. So that's what I wanted to talk about. What do you think about this? What do you think India should do vis-a-vis the China relationship? Let me know in the comments below. And what do you think what's happening in Georgia? Who do you think is behind this? Is it a natural, organic democratic process that we are seeing all these protests, or is it being orchestrated from, by somebody else from outside Georgia? Do let me know in the comments below. Thank you for watching, and I will see you very soon in less than 24 hours in the next live stream, which is the Ask Abhijit Show tomorrow evening. Until then, take care. Thank you very much for watching, and I'll see you very soon. Bye.